listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sound and culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
Hello, and welcome to Listening In with Sounding Out. I'm your host, James Tilstey.
I'm your co-host, Shauna Bossen.
And thank you for listening. We're here courtesy of the Sounding Out blog, which can be found at soundstudiesblog.com. Sounding Out is co-edited by a professor here on campus, Professor Jennifer Stover, and we are here representing her. And we have a very fun interview for you today. We'll be talking about the most recent article published on the Sounding Out blog, The Queer Sound of Dandiyot Queen Falguni Pathak. Here we have a guest on the line. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Oh, sure. Hi. My name is Pavitra Sundar, and I teach at Hamilton College. And I work on sound studies, South Asian studies, post-colonial literature, a whole bunch of stuff.
Pavitra, thank you so much for joining us today. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could just go through and maybe just summarize some of the key points of your article for some people listening who may be unfamiliar.
So my article is about this singer called Falguni Pathak, an Indian pop singer, and she rose to fame in the 1990s as a lot of non-film singers were coming into the limelight. And what's really striking about her is that there's an apparent mismatch between how she sounds and how she looks. So she sounds really, really conventional, has a really sort of sweet, high-pitched voice, sings of romantic, girly things. But her appearance is, kind of soft butch, right? She's always dressed in masculine clothing, and is very comfortable in this sort of gender queerness. And in 1990s India, this was which is when she sort of emerged on the scene, this was a really startling she was a really startling figure, and sort of surprisingly has continued to be that kind of startling figure, right? There isn't anybody else or anybody as famous, I should say, who, sort of performs in the way that she does with this kind of mismatched image and sound.
So when you talk about, I feel like most American pop stars, I don't know that much about Indian music, which may be a setback for this show and this topic, but I feel like with a lot of American pop stars that I know of, if they're really popular, everybody has this preconceived notion about them. And there's something like Taylor Swift, for example, the first thing that I think about her is like being like this very country girl, America's really country girl. So with Pathak, was the first, like, what was this discrepancy between her visual presented identity and the way that she sounded? Was that like the first thing that people thought of her and the first thing that she was identified by?
That's certainly one of the main things, right, that jumps out at people and people would talk about. And in interviews, she would constantly get asked about why she always wears, trousers and a T-shirt or a suit and so forth. She always got asked this question. So yes, I think that was one of the main things she was and continues to be remembered for. The other thing that people really know her for is the fact that her look doesn't seem to bother or doesn't seem to stop her from performing not just these heteronormative love songs, right? So pretty traditional, sort of straight romantic tales, but also religious stuff. So right now, she is known as a singer of these traditional Hindu festival songs. So again, there's this mismatch in the, not just in her look and sound, but in the kind of songs she sings, right, which seems really traditional. So yeah, absolutely.
So
that's what people know her for.
Do you think that Pathak, who you mentioned in your article, actually was not very open about any kind of romantic entanglements, is actually kind of just refrained or just said, like, it's not something she wants to talk about? Do you think when singing songs from this position of kind of a typical, like, heteronormative relationship, do you think that it takes she takes kind of a place of a neutral spectator or tries to live vicariously through them? Do you think it's more one or the other? Do you think it's just kind of this presentation and of a story from kind of this third-party narrator, and that's what appeals to it to a lot of people?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I guess in my reading of her music videos, she's not at all a neutral party, right? Because she often appears in the music videos itself as herself. And in her role as the singer and narrator, she's kind of helping the, you know, it's usually a teenage girl who's in love and sort of pining for her lover, right? And she's usually helping along that character, right? So it's not like she's taking an oppositional stance, but it's very much involved in the romantic tale and sort of helping it along. But I wouldn't necessarily call it a vicarious position, because I think part of what her role is in these songs is to, there's a lot of sort of homosocial stuff going on in the songs as well. So a lot of you know, female bonding in some of the songs. She is sort of the character seems to be pining for her, right? Either as a friend or as a pop star. So I wouldn't say that she's living vicariously. I think she's made a choice, as a lot of pop stars do, about how to present her how to sort of separate out her private life and her public life. But the interesting thing for me is that that sort of plays into this ambiguity that's already there in her music videos and in the mismatch between her sound and image. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. No, and I think that that's, I mean, first of all, I really am interested in, you kind of touched upon it, but I'm still confused. I'm not knowing that much about her, you know, because sometimes these kinds of cultures don't permeate American culture that prominently. As to, first of all, why she chose these very specific scenarios, not necessarily the subjects of female bonding, but I did watch her first music video that was in the article, and the images of, like, schoolgirls in, like, that very specific, you know, pleated skirt kind of, they have the same scrunchies, that kind of thing, and they are so overdramatic about their feelings for what may be a classmate. I'm really interested in why she might have chosen that subject. And also, another thing, coming from an American listening perspective, one thing that you talk about a lot in your piece is how Pathak sounded very cute to other people, to other people in India. And I wanted to ask if you could just go into what that sounds like in the greater context of, I guess, Indian music, popular Indian music, because I wasn't really sure where the difference was between what you might hear otherwise.
Right. Okay, so let me think. First question, the choice of the narratives in the music videos, right?
Yes.
And I'm not sure to what extent this choice was hers or her production team's, right? But in any case, I think that she was not the only one who was sort of capitalizing on that kind of narrative, right? There were other films, for instance, in the 1990s, mainstream Hindi films, what we now call Bollywood here, that had those kinds of romantic narratives set in sort of teen school, like early college settings. So in some sense, she's using that, right? That more extended narrative that you get in the 2.5-3 hour Bollywood film, in the, you know, 4 minute or whatever the length of these songs is. So she's building on something that is familiar. What you also see in those romantic narratives is that the protagonists are always, there's just a lot of stuff that they're working with, right? There's like stuffed animals and chocolates, and they're going to concerts. And and that, I think, is important because it's marking a certain consumer culture, right, that we might take for granted, but in the 1990s in India was something that middle-class people were just sort of, there were these huge shifts in public life at that time, because of changes in the economic policy of the government. And so a lot of commodities, consumer items, were just being introduced and they were just flooding the market. So it's marking a particular lifestyle choice, right, that these kids in these videos have access to and that presumably the audience could aspire to. Mm-hmm. So I think that's all of, you know, it's these images of desirable people, images, lifestyles, commodities that's in play in her music videos. Does that answer the first question?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's... please, I wouldn't want to interrupt you.
Well, no, I think these things are, you know, stuff we take for granted, but it was such a seismic shift in popular culture and consumer culture in India at the time, and that for anybody who grew up in India at that moment or who studies that period of India, right, it's very, very remarkable, that shift.
I think to one thing you used to open this article was Deepa Mehta's Fire, which was a 1998 mm-hmm. film, you cited as showing a intimate relationship between two women, which kind of sparked a lot of controversy and discussion in mm-hmm. India, mm-hmm. as kind mm-hmm. of kind of made a profound cultural impact in that regard. And I was wondering, mm-hmm. do you think that that pop stars like Pathak would have had an outlet to express this kind of this new image in popular music had it not been for films like this?
Not necessarily. I don't think it was Deepa Mehta's Fire that necessarily allowed her to create these kind of videos.
So perhaps could I rephrase that question? Do you think that movie, in conjunction with Pathak's image, speaks to a greater cultural shift that was happening in India at that time?
Yeah, for sure. There were other representations of sort of homosocial interactions in popular films in the past, but I think what's different in these later moments is that cultural texts is that they begin to get read as queer, right? So after Deepa Mehta's Fire, which makes explicit a queer relationship between two women, it's hard to sort of not read queerness in visual representations, right? So I think that's the shift that happened in the 1990s. There were lots of other representations beforehand, but they were read in other ways. Visibility, that's why visibility matters, I think. Mm.
I guess that speaks to a sentence that you had in your article where you say, it matters not only that one is out, but that one is seen as such. Mm-hmm. And I think that's mm-hmm. the biggest distinction you're making here, correct? Is that...
I'm so glad that's coming through, you know, because I really thought hard about how I wanted to phrase that.
The other thing I wanted to address was you talk about how in one of the music videos, there's outfits that characters don that reference both Moulin Rouge and The Mummy Returns. I was wondering if these mm-hmm. are representative of a sense of Western culture influencing Andy at this time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think so. And I think that's also part of this shift in popular culture in the 1990s that's happening because of economic liberalization. There's just more such images and texts that are circulating, particularly on television, right? So you get more music. You get MTV in India, right? In the 1990s, you get music videos from other places. There's also these underground circuits of films from across the world that are just more readily available and that circulate. So I think, yeah, that's part of it. I guess I want to also return to that other question about the cuteness of the video. And I think I meant in the narrative itself, right? And she often gets talked about as her songs get often talked about as cute because of their narratives, right? The teen love stories and they're not edgy, even though I say it's, you know, the Mummy Returns and the Lady Gaga references, Lady Marmalade references are campy. it's still not, it's still, in the end, it's still a sort of cute, happy love story. Her voice gets talked about as sweet, right? And I think it's because of that pitch of her voice being really high pitched. And that, in that kind of voice, soprano voice, gets read as sweet, partly because in Hindi cinema, for four decades, you've had a voice that was sweet and unadorned, and that came to represent ideal Indian femininity. Right? So it's in the context of other pop cultural sounds that Pathak's voice then gets cast as sweet. Mm-hmm. Because why? I mean, why should a soprano voice be thought of as sweet necessarily? Right? Right. There's no inherent connection there.
Right, right. I think that it, at least in American culture, it's been very much stereotyped as being like kind of being innate to femininity, just because of the stark difference between feminine voices versus masculine voices, which I actually do have a question about in just a minute. I just wanted to ask if you could clarify what you just said about the narrative of her songs being kind of intrinsic to her cuteness. Does the narrative stand by itself within the songs and the lyrics? Or does that also have to do with the videos that she was producing?
Yeah, I think it's in the videos, actually. I don't think it's, there are clear stories being told in all of her or most of her songs. Mm-hmm. They're often capturing a feeling, you know, or a sentiment rather than telling a story in the song. So the story, I think, really comes through in the music videos.
So do you think that this kind of inherent cuteness that she has, would that be apparent to somebody who had only heard an audio clip of the song, or would you need both of those factors, audio and visual?
That's a great question.
I'm not sure if people would have even had the opportunity, if she was really popular, you know, if people would have even had the opportunity to not have seen her video. I feel like sometimes that kind of mass production makes it difficult.
Yeah,
but
yeah, I was actually trying to, when you asked the question, I was trying to imagine a moment when I had just heard her and not immediately also pictured her, right? Mm-hmm. And I think because her video circulated on television, and that was the basis of her popularity, it's really hard, I think, to separate sound and image, right, mm-hmm. in her case. And I think that's the point I try to end with in the blog post, that you cannot understand sound without understanding image, just as we sound scholars have been trying to say for a while now, that you cannot understand image without sound.
Right. Right, yeah. So that actually led me to something else that I wanted to ask about. What we just talked about being that masculine versus feminine voices are obviously really, really identifiable. You mention in the body of your article about this idea that no matter how intensely you listen, no queer timbre reaches out to you. I feel like that kind of queerness is sometimes a really visual effect. And I wanted to know if you had any examples or any idea or could explain what a queer timbre or queer sound might be.
Yeah, I think in the Indian case, it's something I think that I'm really still trying to work out. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, what would a queer sound really sound like in the Indian context? And ultimately, I think my argument is that in some ways, even if she doesn't have what we might call a queer timbre in from a Euro-American perspective, she, because we have to read sound and image together, she is a queer figure, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's, at least in her case, there's no way to just to say, well, this part of her is queer and this part of her is not, right? It's the conjunction of those things that is queer. And I think also that queerness is not, the sound of queerness, the look of queerness, is not the same in across different contexts, right? So just as I think the sound, what counts as masculine sounds, what counts as feminine sounds, is not the same across contexts, right? So as much as our, you know, voices of masculinity and femininity are in part about the body, they're also learned ways of vocalizing, so that people, what might sound like a clearly masculine voice in one context is not necessarily easily readable as such in another.
Mm-hmm.
Pavricha, I also want to mention, last week we interviewed Claire Cooley, who issued the first article from the Gendered Soundscapes of India series, which was gender in the first sound films in 1930s Bombay. And I noticed there's actually an interesting correlation between your article and her article, which is that as technology is kind of developed in India, it's given way to the opportunity of kind of questioning social norms, questioning, you know, the fluidity of gender itself, and kind of giving a new platform to present these questions to society at large through new technology and new mediums. You know, in Cooley's article, it's the first movies with sound. In your article, I see it as the advent of satellite television and people, the kind of diffusion of Western culture into Indian culture and the kind of music and culture that's produced as a result of that. I was wondering if you think there's a correlation between that too. Does technology kind of give way to the ability to question social norms?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Technology shifts how we live culture, I think, how we live our daily lives. And I think those shifts enable shifts in social norms, social values, and so forth. So, and it that said, I don't want to make a sort of functionalist argument, meaning that I don't want to see that saying that technology causes it, right?
Correct. Yeah.
But that it creates the circumstances, right, through which different practitioners, different cultural producers, right, might engage differently and produce different kinds of texts that then raise different kinds of questions. But absolutely, I think there's no question that technology is really a part of these shifts in culture and facilitate them.
Yeah. I mean, me and Shauna were actually even speaking. You kind of see this reflexive in our own culture, too. I mean, as the internet's kind of grown in popularity and we've seen social media become like a massive means of communication, there's also more of an encouragement towards gender fluidity and an open discussion about things. And I do think it's interesting to look back and see how this correlation has kind of impacted people. I see them fundamentally all as kind of ways of advancing our means of communication and just kind of a way of spreading ideas and kind of allowing culture and, you know, just social progression to work more fluidly.
That makes sense. Yeah, I mean, I guess we shouldn't, the one caution I'd have is that we shouldn't, I think we should be wary of sort of arguments about technology and progress, you know, that because we have certain technologies, so we are better than in a moment of the past. And I don't think you were making that argument.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, people often fall into that trap, but I do think technology facilitates
is the right word, correct?
Yeah, different kinds of engagements. Yeah.
Well, we're getting kind of close to the end of our time, and I just wanted to ask you about something that I personally keep coming back to, you know, throughout this discussion, which is that the Pathak led a pretty private life by most pop star standards, right? And she was assigned this queer identity and this kind of like queer idolism because of this discrepancy between you know, how she sounded and how she appeared visually. I think that it's really interesting that regardless of the fact that she didn't, you know, really comment on her personal romantic life, that people assigned this to her, although I understand why that would be, given all of the other, the fact that she dressed in a, you know, more masculine way, of course, is the biggest indicator of this and what we talked about with her music videos. Were there other like pop stars at this time that people that could have been something similar to these kinds of icons in India in the 1990s, or was she like more at the forefront of this movement?
I think there certainly were other queer figures, but I think they all managed this sort of the rumors and the suggestions of their sexual lives different, you know, in different ways. And so there were also other people who were, you know, apparently heterosexual, and they're as far as you could tell from their public persona, and yet they were still queer icons, right, regardless of whether or not they were straight or gay or whatever else. So I think there were other figures, but she does, for me, stand out because there were few other people, a few other women who performed this kind of masculinity, right, or gender queerness in public life, and have done so consistently that she's the only one to have essentially performed the same role for 30 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me, she stands out for that reason. But were there other queer icons in public culture? Certainly. Just not ones like her.
Pavitra, we're closing in on the end of our interview. I was wondering if you had any last thoughts or anything you want to share with the audience before we go.
No, I don't have anything specific other than just listen a lot. And like, every time you're listening, just ask yourself why we're interpreting things the way we are, you know. I just want everyone to take away that from anything you ever read on the Sound Studies blog.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us, Pavitra. Again, this has been Listening In with Sounding Out. You can find us online at soundstudiesblog.com. Thank you so much for listening, and stay
tuned. Thank you. You're very kind readers and listeners.
Absolutely.
Thank you.